Esther 7. Esther 7, verses 1 through 4. So the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, "What is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? And it shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom." Then Esther the queen answered and said, "If I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage." Solomon in Proverbs 27:1 warns, "Boast not thyself of tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring forth." A great warning for all, a great example of the seriousness of this in the case of Haman. Think about that. The day before, Haman had been boasting, and he was swelled up with pride at the thought of eliminating his mortal enemy, Mordecai. He loved that thought, overseeing the extermination of the entire Jewish nation. He was next to the king in power and prestige, while at that time, seemingly, he had his enemy or his enemies under his feet. And yet, one sleepless night later, everything has changed. His enemy, Mordecai, has now come into favor with the king. And through his own boastfulness, Haman has revealed the vanity of his self-conceit by giving advice that leads to Mordecai being exalted and his own position becoming imperiled. Haman's prospects then have dimmed exponentially as he's been made to watch the rising prospects of Mordecai and the Jews. And so as Haman goes to his home, after he's been reminded of his now downgraded position, he has every reason to be apprehensive about his future, doesn't he? Indeed, as he returns to his home, therefore, he covers his head. He's in shame and he's in shock. In Haman, then, we're reminded of the uncertainties of his present life. Haman's case enforces that which is said in the Psalms, in Psalm 146:3. "Put not your trust in princes, nor in the son of man, in whom there is no help." Haman will find, like all who trust in them, that the favor of princes, the trust of princes and of kings and of great and noble men in this life, that is fickle. And their kindnesses today very often turn to cruelties tomorrow. All of Haman's outward securities are now seen to be props with any foundation whatsoever. His various avenues of counsel, his various means for securing his designs have been so many winds driven and tossing all before them. And the reason is this. the king's heart is not in Haman's hand. Solomon tells us that the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, and that he turns it whithersoever he desires. And that truth is very apparent now in the life of Haman. Now, as noted, Haman did not even perceive himself to be the man who was the most noble prince of the kingdom. But it is hard, isn't it, to think that the people of the capital city, Shushan, at least there, that they didn't perceive him to be so. Right? Unless you had your head in the ground like an ostrich. Unless you had your head in some sort of echo chamber. It would have been hard to be in Shushan and not notice a guy like Haman. Right? Remember, everywhere he went, people had to bow down and recognize him. Isn't it amazing then that Haman doesn't realize that he, in giving his advice, that the most noble prince should lead around this one who's to be honored, that he wouldn't be talking about himself? He didn't recognize in that person himself, when everyone else in the capital city must have recognized that. And moreover, the king appears to have been entirely unaware of this raging contest between Mordecai and Haman. Though, again, because of Haman's behavior with respect to Mordecai and the things that we're told, it's hard to believe that the people in the city of Shushan were unaware of it. Might be possible, if you're the king, to be in your throne room and so wrapped up in matters of state that you're not really tuned in to what's going on here between Haman and Mordecai, this contest. But surely the people of Shushan are aware. And why do I bring this up? Because I think all of this is important. It's all important to keep in mind when we think upon what must have been that very surprising or even ironic display that wouldn't have been lost upon those common people in Shushan when they saw Haman leading Mordecai all around the city proclaiming his honor. Now next, I want you to consider once more the enviable position of Haman as he returned to his house. He just had a very bad day. In fact, bad is probably underestimating how terrible it really was. But rather than meeting with comfort when he went home, he meets with certain prognostications of his ultimate defeat. And these are given by those who had offered him so much bad counsel earlier in that day, his wife and his friends. Remember, they're the ones who told him, you know, build the gallows, go see the king. They're the ones who were pushing him forward and getting rid of Mordecai right away like he wanted. They weren't counseling any caution at that time. But now, now that they can see how all of this has turned out, well, they're, I think, pretty quick to begin to cut their ties to Haman. Truly, then, we see that bad counselors, and this is a truth I think that applies to all of life, but bad counselors ultimately prove to be poor comforters. And Haman's retreat allows him no opportunity then to repent or even to re-engage in a more constructive manner. But everything seems now to be bound over to an inexorable fatalism if we listen to these sayings of his wife and friends. Indeed, his wife and friends predict his speedy ruin. And they're quick at this point to mention two things in particular. First, they note the change of fortune as they would conceive it to be. There's been a change, a big change and a bad change. They saw Mordecai rising while Haman was falling in favor. In the pagan mind, the wheel of fortune has turned to favor Mordecai against Haman. And they had lived undoubtedly through the rise and fall of a number of what we would call court parasites. It would have been nothing unusual then for them to see one man rise, and not just one man rise, but rise upon the demise or the decline of another. With all of that store of knowledge, therefore, it seemed certain to them that this new streak of luck that Mordecai was having, that would push him over the top to the height of political power, and he would surely replace Haman in the royal court. That's their first prediction. Second, as they contemplate this, they come to understand very quickly, this change portends the ultimate failure of Haman's plot against the Jews. The entire kingdom knew of this decree. And if the entire kingdom knew, it has to be a certainty then that those who are familiar with Haman, that they would not only know about it, but they would be more intimate with the reasons, the offenses, and the details that made up this plot. All the ingredients that went into this terrible decree. Now, knowing that Haman was at this point teetering on the edge of what they clearly perceived to be personal disaster, those who had, in all likelihood, probably helped him devise the plan, the original plot, at some level, but certainly had given him all this bad counsel earlier that day, now they could see the folly of this whole enterprise. And now it appears that very likely they want to remove themselves at least one step from any implication in the plot when Haman, as they perceive it, surely falls. Now, that's possible for all of them except, of course, for Zeresh, his wife. When we consider that, we can understand then the sentiment of the psalmist, can't we? When the psalmist says, "The heathen imagine a vain thing." In Psalm 2. Think about that. They who would eradicate the Jews, those who would thwart the coming of Messiah, that's really what they're trying to do. In Esther, however, we see the rest of that psalm. "He who sits upon the throne of heaven is laughing at their folly." And in all of these events, he's casting down one by one their vain imaginations. The divine intention is clear even to Haman's friends, who now, as I pointed out before, are characterized as wise men because they see the end of this council. They see the end of the matter. And they see now that their council was unable to overcome the predictions of Scripture that Israel would destroy Amalek forever. Calling them wise men reminds us that they have, in fact, acknowledged the teaching of Scripture here. And that reminds us that our wisdom is not merely in having the Scriptures, but in believing the Scriptures. They had the Scriptures before this, but now, by the turn of events, they've come to believe them. Now, there's also, I think, a reason here to pause and consider that the redemption of the people of God is near. Right? As Peter tells us in 2 Peter 2:9, the Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. And that's what's happening here. And it's happening together. We need to understand that. You know, a lot of people, they like the idea of heaven, but they hate the idea of hell. They like the idea of a judgment day when men are acquitted before God, but they don't like the idea of condemnation. And yet, throughout Scripture, these two things go hand in hand. You can't really have one without the other. You're not going to have the deliverance of the godly without the judgment of the wicked. So when you see the judgment of the wicked near, you know, or you should know, that the redemption of the people of God is near as well. Because they tend to go hand in hand. When the night of despair seems darkest, it's important then to remember that the break of day is most near. And here is real comfort then for persecuted believers in the book of Esther. But finally, Haman may have tried to present his bad case in the best light that he could conceive of. And yet the reaction and response of his wife and friends brought everything, or at least should have brought everything, into perspective for him, as well as it clearly did for them. And just as all of this is being brought into that perspective, that clarity of thought, that moment when the truth of Scripture crystallizes and the situation is clearly discernible, just at that moment, Haman is left to contemplate the suffering that's coming for him. And if he cared at all for anyone but himself, he had to know it was coming for his family as well. And if he did, just now, if ever a man could have any regret, he would have started to regret that his wife and family are going to be involved in his ruin, because seldom does a man fall alone. Ask Adam. As the events hasten in unfolding, Haman stood momentarily, but he has to be wondering now what could possibly go wrong next, right? He knows that there's a problem. And just then, as he's standing there getting a sense that something is out of line. Maybe this isn't going to turn out nearly as well as I thought. The king's chamberlains appear to escort him to Esther's second banquet. And that brings us to chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen. So the king and Haman came. The chapter begins here with what is a typical Hebrew conjunction, which indicates the continuance of the narrative. But the translators chose the word so rather than and. And they do so, I think, actually with pretty good reason. In fact, I know some people have indicated, at least the way some of these commentaries run, some of them indicate that they think the chapter division seems here to be slightly off. They think that the previous verse, in chapter 6, verse 14, that would have fit better at the beginning of this chapter. But we have to understand two things. Number one, the previous verse, verse 14 of chapter 6, explained the break in action, the interruption that moves us from Haman's house back to the palace. But number two, it deliberately leaves the conversation in Haman's house hanging in an unfinished fashion, drawing Haman from these dire predictions of his wife and friends back to where the center of action will take place in the palace. Additionally, this chapter represents a change of venue, chapter 7, which discloses Haman's ultimate fate. So the chapter division, though I understand why some people think it's somewhat difficult or clunky here, it does represent a change in narrative context, which is necessary to conclude one of the storylines that we find in the book of Esther. So it's not an unreasonable way, and there really isn't any reason to think that we should be placing this somewhere else. Although, I know some people have indicated they think it should be. In this first verse, we see the king and Haman are going to be the primary characters in this chapter. That really, there is something going on here between them. It's an interaction that becomes a definitive one for Haman's fate, his final disposition in this story. So having sent his chamberlains, his eunuchs, to bring Haman to the banquet, we see now that the entrance of both men is placed on an equal footing in chapter 7. And that, again, is another reason why this is an appropriate verse to begin chapter 7. So it opens with these men placed on seemingly equal footing, but we know that this isn't going to be for long. We know because of what has gone before, and even if we haven't read to the end of chapter 7, there's enough foreshadowing going on in the story that we should be suspicious if Haman gets out of this alive. Both men enter as Esther's guests, being previously invited to the second banquet the previous night at the previous banquet. Both men actually enter this scene with the hope of resolving some question. The king's question is pretty clear. The king wants to know what it is that's ailing the queen. Why did she behave in the way that she did? You know, what's making her tick? Haman, on the other hand, I think, however, if he has a question, and I think he probably does, at least for a moment, he's entering this scene hoping to discover what degree of favor he may still have in the sight of the queen. Right? Remember the way he talked about being invited to that first banquet? He was all full of pride, and his vanity had him all kinds of puffed up. His vanity has convinced him that he's being invited because he's the one being honored. After all, he's the only one in his mind, at least earlier that day, he was the only one that he could even imagine worthy of honor. And quite frankly, nothing in this particular dynamic has changed that. And Haman is such a proud or vain man, it's hard to imagine that anything has changed his mind with respect to this banqueting. But he's still going to go into it thinking that he is right up there with the king, at least in the queen's sight. So his question has to be then, you know, how much favor do I have? Remember, he is aware of this eroding confidence on the part of the king. But for him, a second banquet, this could mean a second chance, a second breath of life. So the king and Haman came to the banquet. Literally, the words, the word that's used here means to drink. They came to drink. It's to be remembered that the chief part of these banquets or feasts that they would have, besides honoring certain guests, was imbibing of a lot of wine, particularly at the end. All right, very quickly, these banquets turned into drunken routs. And what we have is our narrative moving us really, without mentioning it, through the course of feasting or dining to that latter portion when the wine is going to begin to flow without stop, nonstop. Now it's here then, after the earlier social and convivial activities surrounding the eating, that the dialogue would have naturally returned to the point at which it had left off the evening before. And that's why the narrator brings us here. This is the important juncture of the story for the purpose of the author of Esther. And this is a point which explains why we're moved to this part of the banqueting without getting into all of the various facets of the earlier dining. The emphasis is just not there. The king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen. It's been noted that in the previous account, we were simply told that Esther prepared the banquet. But here, we're told that the banqueting, particularly the drinking afterward, apparently includes her. Now, in this, we see that she, if she had been sort of in the background the first time, she's moving into the foreground. She's set to play an important part in what is going to transpire between the king and Haman. Additionally, I think by referring to Esther as the queen here, we're being reminded that she occupies a place of dignity in the kingdom. One which represents a special relation to the king, in fact. And so here we see Esther, whose name, remember, means star, shining in her official title in anticipation of the full deliverance of the Jews. The point of this is, what we're seeing here is that Esther has not been diminished at all by the previous day's events. But in fact, if anything, we are being led by the narrative to see that her office has become perhaps even more significant with the diminishing of Haman. Verse 2. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, "What is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee, and what is thy request, and it shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom." And the king said again unto Esther. These words bring us to consider that despite the events of the day that are related in the narrative, the king's mind has remained fixed on the business of the queen from the day before. There is seemingly, although we know all this stuff has happened, there's seemingly, in at least from the point of view of the king, been virtually nothing that has transpired. But he's still right there where he was the day before, asking the same question. No sooner does the narrator bring us to the end of the banquet then we're faced with the immediacy of the unfinished business that has propelled the king to hasten the whole affair. Remember, he sent chamberlains to hasten Haman to get to that banquet. Come on, we want to go. I want an answer. It's clear he wants to know the reason for Esther's seeming recklessness in approaching the throne unsummoned a couple of days earlier. Or I should say, you know, just a little over a day earlier. Now, having dispatched the whole matter pertaining to Mordecai earlier in the day, it may well be that Ahasuerus is feeling quite secure that he's laid what in his mind would be sort of the proper cosmic foundation for bringing resolution to other problems as well. Right? He may actually be feeling like he's in a better position, if anything, today than he was the day before because of the Mordecai affair. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that he has yet come to associate Esther with Mordecai. I don't think he is necessarily even aware of that relation yet. But the text tells us that what he says is repetition. Again. King said again. Had the reader, or had Esther, wondered if the king's disposition toward her had been changed with the rewarding of Mordecai or the subjecting of Haman to the humiliation of leading Mordecai around Shushan, well, the answer is not really far off, is it? That might have been uncertain. And Esther, being where she is, positioned as she is, she knows very clearly what's happened with Mordecai. She also probably has a pretty good idea of the effect that that's had on Haman. So there may be a moment here as things are beginning, when the talk begins, where she's not quite sure if things have changed. And when things change with the king, because he's so volatile, you cannot be absolutely certain that those things have changed in a good way. That things have gotten better. That your prospects have gotten better. It may be or it may not be. She doesn't really know. But the answer is not far. It's true the king has shown himself to be unstable and often weak. He's a weak despot from time to time. But I think we need to remember, as we can see in the book of Esther, there's something greater now working through him. Indeed, Esther herself had seen that Ahasuerus' attitude toward the Jews couldn't be one of fixed hostility. Otherwise, the fact is, he would not have rewarded Mordecai, would he? So she does at least have that bit of knowledge. The king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine. In Hosea 6, verse 2, the prophet says, after 2 days he will revive us, in the third day he will raise us up, and we shall live in his sight. The second day here is, in fact, as the prophet says, a day of reviving in preparation for the resurrection. It's not the full deliverance, is it? But it certainly does appear to be a reviving. So the second day reviving of Hosea proves to be true for Esther and the Jews as well. At the first banquet, there were a lot of things that hadn't yet been revealed. For example, the disposition of the king toward Mordecai and the Jews. Didn't really know. We didn't know if Ahasuerus was simply a congenital anti-Semite, or if there was something else at work. We didn't know yet anything about the uncertainty of Haman's claims to power and authority. Is this a lock? Or is there a possibility that he could be bumped out of the way? That he could be demoted? He could be degraded in some way? We really didn't know. We also didn't really know the degree of Haman's hatred of Mordecai. We knew it in the sense that we knew he hated Mordecai and all Jews, but we didn't perhaps realize that his hatred was so great that he was willing to sacrifice a strategic approach to destroying Mordecai and the Jews. But that's become clear. We didn't know the frailty of Haman's friendship with those men that are wise men who evidently are starting to cut their ties, and that represents really the tip of the spear as men throughout the empire begin to want to distance themselves from Haman. You know, when you're in power and you seem to be insulated from any kind of consequence, you seem to be occupying a bulletproof position. But once Haman starts to stumble, it's amazing how quickly the rats are fleeing the ship. And that becomes more and more apparent later in the book. Not maybe so much apparent in chapter 7, but as we proceed, we'll see that. So all these things, they weren't known at the first banquet, but we're getting a glimpse of all of this. All of this becomes important not only for Esther and her confidence before the king, but I would also say this is important for us if we're going to have a deeper and abiding spiritual perspective for the people of God for all time from the book of Esther. Because it's teaching us something about human nature as well as about the way God works through fallen human nature. The second day then represents a complete shift from the momentum in place at the prior banquet simply one evening before. Again, this is noted to be a banquet of wine. It was a feast set for celebration and for honor. And because of this, Haman's vanity, perhaps together with some of the wine, will cloud his judgment. And Haman's in a very unenviable position, because remember, that bad counsel and now the poor prognostications, these things are all pointing to his demise. And this is eroding within him that confidence that I noted last time that he would need when he's going to deal with the king. But beyond that, his vanity, his belief that he has maybe special favor with the queen, perhaps with the drinking of the wine now, all will cloud his judgment, and all of this is going to contribute to bringing him down. Right. The warnings issued by the wise man and his wife right before he's escorted to this feast would disappear, in a sense, when he's taken into this banquet where, because of his vanity, he's sure he's worthy of honor. And so he has this emptiness that's playing hide and seek with him right now. And every time he needs something solid, as the story progresses, you're going to find he goes to lean back and there's nothing there. For this very reason, You know, he moves forward and he advances himself based on a lot of self-delusion and vanity, and ends up retreating again and again to a position of nothingness. Every aspect of the trap, then, is that's going to take him is made sure by his vanity. And it's made strong by his lack of any real support. King said again unto Esther on the second day of the banquet of wine, "What is thy petition, Queen Esther?" What's thy petition? By repeating these words from the previous night, the king is actually giving every assurance that he bears the same generous spirit toward Esther that he did not only the night before, but remember, in his initial receiving of her into his presence without summoning her. Here, in fact, I would say we see the insistence of the king to discover the real cause of her venturing to come before him. Surely he's intimating it was not merely to call me or Haman to these banquets, right? I don't believe that he is under any false assumptions here. It should be remembered, I would say, that the word for petition refers to some possible demand that she might have. In fact, he continues, I think, to recognize she might have felt impelled by some outward consideration, something outside of herself, to this rash course of coming before him unannounced and unsummoned. Now, however, he reminds her of her title, and I think this is important. He reminds her of her title, and he calls her by name, Queen Esther. When he does this, he's giving her a twofold assurance of his goodwill. First, he is assuring her she is his queen, and he intends to honor her as such. But second, she is his Esther, his star, the wife that he actually loves. What is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. Again, we should recall that he said this before. And we have every reason to believe he meant everything implied in this statement. Fact is, I noted earlier on this phrase can connote a willingness to give even on a sacrificial scale. The restatement then assures us that the king's disposition toward his wife has not taken any turn for the worse. If we were uncertain a moment ago as he's talking, then the more he talks, the more we understand his resolve toward her has not changed. It appears that though some things have changed since yesterday, there's still no reason to number the ardor of the king's affection for his wife among them. And he is still interested in her. He's still concerned for her. He still loves her. What is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? So lest she should think that he had dampened and concerned for her in any way, he repeats the second question. What's thy request, or thy desire, thy wish? Perhaps he's intimating by this that there was some deep interpersonal reason that had moved her to come before him the way she had. Ahasuerus, by saying this, I think, is indicating he doesn't really care so much for the motive. It's not to say he doesn't care at all, but he's more concerned in speaking to her to demonstrate that he really does want her. He does love her. He does have a deep and abiding concern for her. He cares enough that he doesn't wish to allow anything undone that would set her world aright. And so he concludes by saying what he said before, and it shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom. And he's saying once again, he's giving every assurance of doing whatever he needs to do, or whatever needs to be done, offering up to the half of his kingdom. Yes, it's his kingdom, but he really means to honor her as queen and is willing to partition the kingdom up to half for her sake. Now, with all of that, I think it is, of course, central to the narrative of the story for us to remember that Haman, once more, is the primary audience before whom this passion play is being enacted right now. This time, what Haman hears is these assurances being given to the queen from a position which has become greatly degraded from where it was the night before. Now, what does this do to him psychologically? His position is sinking sand. Esther's position, as he hears this unfold, he comes to understand her position remains solid, right? He knows that his place in the court is actually facing a challenge of existential proportions, at least if he's listened to his wife and his friends right before the chamberlains came to get him. So if he is entertaining any sense of hopefulness at all, what he has to be doing right about now is shifting all of his hope to Esther, as he hears the king's unwavering love and commitment to her being expressed in this way. Right? And of course, and here's the problem for Haman. Such is Haman's vanity. We can only imagine how quickly he's going to take hold of that slender pretext of being now a favorite of Esther. Even if his favor with the king is fading, he's willing to throw everything into that basket. Because he thinks, deep down inside, that he's really worth it, that he's really worthy. And it's this kind of thinking that will be his final undoing. Verse 3. Then Esther the queen answered and said, "If I found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request." But the queen, Esther the queen here, we're told, gives answer. She's answering the king. Now, once more, I would suggest using the title along with her name, what the narrator is doing is inviting us to see Esther responding in the character that Ahasuerus had projected upon her. And as such, the character in which Ahasuerus has promised to uphold her when he extends his generous offers to her. There are going to be no more delays, however. Esther's response is now meant to be a direct answer to the king's queries, right? At last, we're going to be allowed to hear the words for which Esther had risked her life. Everything from the moment she entered that throne room unsummoned up until now is wrapped up in what she's about to say. Now, it's been noted by some commentators that this delay had only been introduced to allow us to see Mordecai's vindication and triumphing over Haman. And there is some truth in that. But we shouldn't think that this was an artificial delay. It was a natural delay, brought about through ordinary means, but a delay which nonetheless displays an extraordinary providence. What Esther wished to say would not have had nearly the significance the day before, as we're going to see. And when I say that, what I mean is what she says would not have provoked the response that we get from Haman the day before. Many things had changed, while somehow the king's devotion to her had only been strengthened. Her words are now spoken into a context that literally did not exist 24 hours ago. And that, as I said, is going to make a tremendous difference here. It's all the difference in the world. And what a difference a day makes. Then Esther the queen answered and said, "If I have found favor in thy sight, O king." You know, it's interesting here. The king had urged her to speak. But in speaking, she is very careful not to violate protocol, is she? It's true. She's his wife. And she was the queen. But she was, in both respects, still his inferior. And therefore she was, despite his many encouragements, she was very circumspect in her approach to him. Now, I think another reason for her carefulness is probably that she's about to turn this feast, which, remember, feast is a place of merriment and celebration and so on, but she's about to turn this feast into a scene of tragic pleading. We're about to go from comedy to tragedy. So she appeals to the favor or grace that she's found in his eyes. She's saying that essentially this: if this is true, if thou art so graciously disposed, thou who art the king, listen, please. Listen attentively while I tell thee the reason for my actions. Right? This is familiar language, isn't it? It's the language of the psalmist when he's beseeching God to listen attentively. "If I found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king." Literally, this Hebrew here means "if it seems good to the king." Again, Esther adds this caveat to make it clear, she's not making any demand from any sense of her own self-worth, even though the king has encouraged her to some extent to do so. Now, that's a notable contrast, isn't it, to Haman, who can't imagine anyone of worth but himself. But Esther is seeking redemption based upon grace, not upon merit. She's offering her request or her demand not from some claim that's rooted in her status as Ahasuerus' wife or even as queen. Indeed, nothing but grace could fix the terrible situation that she's about to reveal. After all, she and her people stand condemned by the law, and they're able to plead nothing in their own defense. In terms of the law of the Medes and Persians, they now stand rightly condemned. Think about that. Their standing in themselves then has been destroyed because the law is against them. And what remains now is only this: condemned and awaiting execution, and all by the law. So Esther's saying, if I found grace and it seems good, which is an appropriate approach to a superior, especially one who is sovereign. "If I found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition." Look what Esther does now. She asks for her own soul or her life. She asks to be preserved as a matter of demand or request. Now, she raises here the specter that there's some outward thing constraining her to make this request. That word petition. She's indicating that she would never have ventured upon this had it not been for some outward force pressing her to do it. So when she's asking for her life, and she's indicating that there is some sort of outward pressure, the king must have been astonished. Right, think about where he is at this point. He must have been thinking, who or what could possibly threaten my queen? Who could threaten one upon whom the king has lavished such tokens of devotion? How could anyone dare assault the comfort and security of his queen? In fact, he had to have thought to himself, who really could threaten her but me? Right? No one else has that power or authority. You can only imagine the shock of this petition in this banqueting room. Now, although the king and Haman and Esther are the only ones who are invited to the banquet, there are other people here. Right? There are all these chamberlains or eunuchs. But once this is asked, everything must have stopped. It must have all become quiet. Any eunuch or chamberlain must have been quieted, and he must have been wondering something like this. Is it I? Is it me? Right? Because for them, think about this, for them there would be this very uncomfortable memory of that unfolding drama that was there in the unveiling of that plot of Bigthana and Teresh. They didn't really know where this was going to end. Let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. To her petition, she adds her wish or desire. And it's similar to what the Apostle Paul says, isn't it, in Romans 10, verse 1. Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. Esther adds her desire for the salvation of her people. The same thing which threatened her, she's indicating, threatened her people. And she's seeking their lives as well as her own. Now, once she says this, these words identify her fully with her people. And she, by saying this, begins to lift the veil of her own identity as a Jewess. I want you to think about this. Since she was answering the king, it probably would have been most fitting had she said something more like this. If I found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king to grant my request, let my life be given me and that of my people. But we see her statement is one made in excitement, in the heat of the moment, as she places life before petition and people before request, because she's a woman in the grip of an extreme passion, even though it's guided by settled principle. It's still a highly charged moment. Verse 4, she continues, for we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we'd been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I'd held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. For we're sold. Here Esther refers back to that promise of Haman to pay vast sums of money for the right to destroy the whole Jewish nation. Remember that? This language not only connotes the subjection of the people, but the contractual element in the whole arrangement. What's interesting is this. Without explicitly indicting the king, Esther is now beginning to allude to his complicity in this matter. What she's saying is this. There was a bargain made. There was an exchange which had reduced her and her people to a position of needing the kind of intervention that could only be achieved through taking that very radical step that she had taken in approaching his throne without being summoned. For we are sold, I and my people. By adding these words, Esther presses her identity with her people. And she can hardly make anything more clear here than that she intends the king to understand that she and her people stand or fall together. Now, there is in this phrase an identity that supposes what could be called solidarity of ethnicity. Right? She couldn't have made such a statement had there not been a real basis upon which to assert this kind of unity. It's true, they shared a common faith. But it's also true, they held a common ancestry which made them all Jews. Why is this significant? Haman's plot, as Esther perceives it, was ethnic as well as religious. But I want you to think about this. The former, the ethnic, was actually the basis for their condemnation. The latter, the religious, was the basis for their redemption. In other words, they were condemned because they were Jews. But God is going to redeem them, not because they're Jews, but because of their faith in the coming Messiah. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. She continues here, describing unto the king, what she and her people had been sold into. Destruction, death, perishing. She's not only choosing the hardest words that she can find, but actually, if we were to look back in Esther 5, I believe, she's using the very words of the decree. She's never mentioned, by the way, the Jews, nor has she said that she was herself a Jewess. But when she brings forward these words, the king now has to know without fail that she's speaking of Haman's plot, and she's implicating the decree that had been sealed by his own signet ring. We are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we'd been sold for bondmen and bondwomen. Now, I want you to look at what Esther's doing here. It's very important to understanding the remainder of this verse. Esther now is going on to explain why she's dared to venture before the king. Isn't that really what he wants to know? Why did you come before me like that, unannounced, unsummoned? She begins by stating this. Had this bargain been for the purpose simply of reducing the Jews to slavery, that wouldn't have been anything new or unusual, right? They had already endured Egyptian bondage that way. With being sold into bondage, after all, there's always that hope of being redeemed. And so she goes on to say, if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I'd held my tongue. If that had been the only threat, slavery, she says she would have remained silent. There would have been no reason to talk. She wouldn't have been pressed by the terms of such bondage to make mention of the situation. Indeed, it might be wondered if such a decree, in fact, would have had any material effect on her station as queen, right? But if we'd been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I'd held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. Now, there are a lot of people who have complained that this last phrase in Hebrew is relatively confusing. Because one of the words appears, I think, only here, and its meaning is not really certain. The Septuagint tries to translate it into Greek, and in Greek they assume that the word means courtyard, and it becomes a very convoluted translation there. And you can see in our translation that it seems to be a bit garbled. But I think if we were to look at the meaning of the whole statement in Hebrew, it's actually relatively clear what Esther's saying. Now, if we understand that she's already declared she would have held her peace if the Jews had only been sold into slavery and not sold into this kind of destruction, what remains is her apology for remaining silent in such a case. Why she would have remained silent. Now, some have thought this, that she's suggesting that the king, especially since he turned down the money, that he would have suffered a great loss, monetary damage, with the destruction of the Jews. And that's why she felt the need now to speak up. In this case, then, the words are understood to mean that she would have remained silent if the king had actually derived some benefit from the plot, but that's not the case when the Jews are just being destroyed. But I don't think that quite catches what's going on. I think rather the meaning is this. What she's saying is this. If the enemy, or the adversary, had not threatened such destruction, that is, had they only threatened slavery, what she's saying is this. She would have deemed that threat to have been of insufficient value, too small a reason to disturb the king with such a matter. That's what she's really saying here. All right, she wouldn't want to bother him about it. However, her point is this, that this is not merely slavery, but death to which the bargain has been made. And that's why she feels constrained by that outward reality to come unannounced and unsummoned before his throne. Now, time-wise, we have to rest at this point. We have to come to an end. And so in parting from the text, I want to reflect upon just one thing. The firmness of the king's resolution, by which he's repeated three times his purpose to honor Esther the queen. In doing this, that old pagan king puts many Christians to shame, who not only fail in godly resolutions, but they're very soon put off and removed from good purposes. And let me just say in conclusion, I think it's a shame of the Reformed Presbyterian Church that she has so often, so easily recanted her covenant engagements when you have an example of a heathen king standing with such steadfastness. Amen.